So if you missed last week, we started a series, just a short series. It's a three-week series. We're in week two right now. We're calling it King Me. And we are trying to spend just a few weeks talking about the self, I think a really important topic. We are bombarded with messages about the self in our world. And we are our thinking is shaped in many different ways related to how we view ourselves. And we thought it was really important to talk about that. We want to understand how we should think about ourselves and if a lot of the messages that we hear in this world are valid or not, and understand what God thinks about ourselves. And so we're trying to do that. If you missed last week, I'd really encourage you to listen to that. These 3 weeks kind of build on themselves. They're definitely a package. And we tried to lay a lot of foundation and open up the conversation last week. But if you did miss last week, I am going to give you a little bit of a recap here right now. And I'm just going to rehash a few of the points that we made last week. And so we'll start by summarizing a few of these points. Number one, we talked about how the Bible indicates that sin is mainly a quest for personal autonomy. So we opened up to the early chapters of Genesis, and we saw that that's how the Bible starts us out. And that a lot of the issue in our world is because we tried to grab a whole lot of authority. We wanted to be king. We wanted to be sovereign. And so we just saw how that's the issue that the Bible presents at the foundation, at the beginning. Secondly, we saw how in the 20th century there was a popularization of what we call existentialism. We define that a little bit through thinkers such as Jean-Paul Sartre. Existentialism, we define in this three-word phrase that is often used, that's existence before essence. And what that means is that it's the idea that we first come to exist, and it's only later that we establish our essence or the meaningfulness to our lives. So first we come into being, and then we discover what's inside of ourselves, and then we express it, and we make something out of ourselves. That's the idea behind existentialism, and it became very popular in the middle of the 20th century. And then it spread. And then it entered into every corner of our lives. That was the next point. We see encouragements to pursue self-interest and self-promotion, and that they can be found in every corner of our world. We look around and we see the fruit of this kind of thinking, this encouragement to focus on ourselves, the encouragement to think actually pretty highly of ourselves. So we gave a whole bunch of examples. Went through a lot of different slogan sayings that we see in different places. We saw that Jean-Paul Sartre influences every department store and every fast food restaurant, and we just see it everywhere. A few of you sent me some things that you observed. I'll just show you a couple of my favorites. This is Coke Zero, and they had a series of cans to go with the football season this fall. And so you get a can of soda here, and it tells you that you are the MVP, you're a winner, you are a legend. This is maybe my favorite, actually. So these are these little packs, you know, of Kleenex. And even when I go to blow my nose, I am told, summon your strength, seize the moment, believe in yourself, and find your fearless. And it's really pretty remarkable. It's just amazing that this kind of thinking is everywhere, and that even the manufacturers of tissue feel compelled to put these kinds of slogans on their product. Okay, that's how much it is permeated. It's just simply everywhere. And we summarize this way of thinking. So if we look at all of these little slogans that we soak in everywhere we go, they tell us these kinds of things. We summarized it this way with these 4 points. Number one, we're told your source of meaning and truth is inside of you. 2, fulfillment will be achieved as you give freedom and absolute credibility to the inclinations that are stirring inside of you. Okay, I'm to look inside, and I will achieve satisfaction if I trust, if I fully trust what's happening inside of there, and then I express it. I give it freedom. Thirdly, therefore, authenticity and self-expression are the highest of virtues. We talked about that for a while. Okay, if I am authentic, if I am able to be me, that is highly, highly commended. And fourthly, we must pursue such virtues insistently and even aggressively. And we talked about how it's not just a soft relativism, but it's a pretty aggressive one. There is a demand in there. So, we saw that in our world. And then fourthly, in recap, we talked about how we have given the self an incredible amount of authority, and that we have made the self king, even God. We have deified the self. So the self creates meaning, the self determines reality, the self establishes right and wrong, the self is to be trusted wholeheartedly, the self has been given power even to forgive. You must forgive yourself. And the idea that we introduce is that we need to think about these kinds of things. We shared Hebrews 5:14, which talks about how solid food is for the mature, for those who have their powers of discernment trained by constant practice to distinguish good from evil. And the purpose of this series is in large part to train ourselves, to hone or to sharpen our powers of discernment so that we are able to distinguish good from evil, because sometimes it's pretty confusing. And we hear a lot of these messages, and there are nuggets of truth in those messages, and yet we must understand how to parse them out, be able to distinguish good from evil. So today, we're going to continue along that line of thought. We're going to expand on some of the things that we shared last week. And really, I want to take it a little further and try to make us aware of other ways that this does get into everything that we do. Hey, we saw all these little slogans out there, all these sayings everywhere, whether it's on our Kleenex or whether it's at McDonald's or wherever. But I want us to have a good understanding also of how this influences the major areas in our lives, the major decisions that we make. And so we're actually going to go through some of these areas for the first part of this message. And we're going to look at how the self influences marriage, work, parenting, the major social issues of our day, and even attitudes towards the church. Again, just to become more aware, I think we have to open our eyes and see the ways that we're affected. Now, those ways may be good or bad. We haven't gotten there yet, but we have to just be aware. We have to open our eyes and really understand how much we're influenced by popular thinking today. Okay, so we'll start with marriage. And for each of these, I'm just going to share a couple observations from different sources. And again, I'm not drawing conclusions right here about whether these are good or bad. We're going to do that in a little while. But I'm just going to describe what is, not necessarily what should be, but this is what is. So with marriage, how has marriage changed, or how has this self-focused philosophy influenced marriage? John Witt, who is a professor at Emory University, describes it this way. He says, the earlier ideal of marriage as a permanent contractual union designed for the sake of mutual love, procreation, and protection is slowly giving way to a new reality of marriage as a terminal sexual contract designed for the gratification of the individual parties. Okay, this is how he would describe it. There is a much greater influence, there's a much greater emphasis on my personal satisfaction within the relationship of marriage. And I think we can see that expressed a little more clearly in this article that this woman, Tara Parker Pope, wrote. She has written several books about marriage, and she's also a New York Times columnist. And she writes this article actually encouraging spouses to think of themselves. The article is entitled, The Happy Marriage is the Me Marriage. And she says, the notion that the best marriages are those that bring satisfaction to the individual may seem counterintuitive. After all, isn't marriage supposed to be about putting the relationship first? Well, not anymore. For centuries, marriage was viewed as an economic and social institution, and the emotional and intellectual needs of the spouses were secondary to the survival of the marriage itself. But in modern relationships, people are looking for a partnership, and they want partners who make their lives more interesting, who help each of them attain valued goals. And so this is something that she's promoting, that it is important to think about your personal goals and that the relationship itself is probably subservient to those personal goals. I was in the airport a couple weekends ago. I was sitting next to this group of young adults, probably just out of college, and I was overhearing their conversation, trying not to eavesdrop too much, but they were speaking loudly. And one of the young women there, she was just out of college, and she was describing her relationship to her friend. And she was in this longer-term relationship with her boyfriend. It sounded like they'd been in a relationship for a couple years, but they weren't really interested immediately in marriage. And she was describing how they had agreed that they really needed to find themselves and pursue personal goals before they considered marriage. And she spoke about this pretty strongly, pretty loudly, and of course that's a common type of mentality, but it just reminded me again, okay, there's something different here. Something has changed in the last century where marriage often is avoided for the sake of being able to pursue self, to pursue personal interests, and it happens quite a bit. We could think about the self and work. Okay, how does this philosophy influence the way we think about work? And this is probably one of the areas that it really influences. You could go to CSU's website and to their admissions page. And of course, one of those slogans right there on the admissions page is let your passion guide you. And so in this institution that is preparing people, of course, for work, the encouragement is to discover passion and let it be your compass and pursue that passion. In fact, the term follow your passion has increased in English books ninefold since 1990. So in the last 30 years, again, that's a dramatic shift. Okay, that little slogan influences a lot, and that's the emphasis. Follow your passion, especially, I think, when it comes to work and vocation. We could ask, why do we work? We could consider the different reasons that have traditionally been given to work or why we pursue work, and we could say, well, to produce something of value, to make a contribution to the world, to provide for needs, of course, sometimes to maintain a family identity. I want to carry on the family business. And these are all certainly true, and they have been traditional reasons that we work. But I would say today, the pursuit of personal passion eclipses them, most certainly. And that when we think about work, we are definitely thinking about what satisfies myself at that passion level. Okay, that's how we think about work. Similarly, when we think about parenting, we parent in a way that is very influenced by these ideas. And we are certainly shaped by our culture. I was interested to find this article by this woman who was writing about the pursuit of passion in our parenting and how we encourage our kids to pursue passion. This is Lisa Heffernan. She's also a New York Times columnist. And she describes the situation where she was at her child's soccer game. And she says, standing on the sidelines of my son's soccer game, I chatted with the younger sibling of one of his teammates. I don't really have a passion like my brother yet, he explained, glancing over at the field, but my parents are helping me look for one. At some point in the last 20 years, the notion of passion as applied to children and teenagers took hold. By the time a child rounds the corner into high school, and certainly before he sets up an account with a common app, the conventional wisdom is that he needs to have a passion that is deep, easy to articulate, well-documented, and makes him stand out from the crowd. Okay, this is the encouragement, certainly, in our parenting. We need to help our children discover that passion that is inside of them and to give them room to fully express that. She also referenced a couple publications that gave advice to high school graduates as they're preparing their applications for college. One of those was from the Washington Post. Washington Post wrote about 10 myths of college admission. And here was myth number one. The myth is colleges are looking for the well-rounded kid. That's a myth. Sorry, no, they're looking for the well-rounded class. Colleges put together their entering class as a mosaic. A few great scholars for each academic department, a handful of athletes, some musicians, dancers, and theater stars, a few for racial and economic diversity, some potential club leaders, etc. Colleges want a kid who is devoted to and excels at something. The word they most often use is passion. Okay, so this is what is promoted here in this list from the Washington Post. You have to understand that if you're going to get into college, you must show passion. In the same way, the U.S. News published three tips to create a killer college application. And again, the number one tip was share your passion. Does your heart sing when you play an instrument, compete in a sport, tutor children, volunteer, or create a new club? When you are passionate about something, it shines through. Whether it's debate team, choir, web design, student council, or tennis, colleges like to see that you are a person with passions. Put these interests on your activity list for college applications and use them whenever possible in admissions and scholarship essays. And we are certainly influenced by this, as I said before. Okay, if you're a parent in this world, you are shaped in some way by this. You feel compelled. I need to help my child search inside of themselves and then express what they find. Yeah, that's just how we parent. Again, we're not talking yet about whether that's right or wrong, but we're certainly saying that's what is. Next, we could go to the self and today's major social issues. Now, when we think about major social issues, especially as they relate to the church and really where the battleground is, of course, what comes to mind are gender-related issues and abortion. And if you're visiting with us, you might think, okay, that's all churches ever talk about, or those issues. That's all Christians are concerned about. Well, I don't think that's true. And yet we must recognize that those are the hot button issues. That's where the heat is. That's where the controversy is. Those issues are so often what turns a person one way or the other. So as we're talking about this, I think we do need to touch on these, but I am going to frame it probably a little bit differently. Because I want to say that these are self issues. Absolutely. And you see this kind of philosophy really influencing the stances that we take one way or the other on these issues. So we'll start with gender issues. And I want to describe this by first summarizing a little bit of a controversy that I noticed earlier this year. I don't know if you guys saw this, but it was pretty fascinating to me. And it started with this tweet from Martina Navratilova. And she said, "You can't just proclaim yourself a female and be able to compete against women." And she went on to elaborate on that. But of course, she is addressing these very hot-button issues where there are a number of people that are transitioning from man to woman but competing in female athletics and cleaning up. And so she tweets this. Now, if you don't know who Martina Navratilova is, she was a former champion tennis player in the 70s and 80s. She's also a lesbian. And so for the last nearly 50 years, she has been on the forefront of trying to fight for homosexual rights. But she tweeted this, and as you can imagine, there was a response. And there was a lot of attack, and there was a lot of accusation towards her of being insensitive and uneducated and bigoted. This is really fascinating to me, though. Now, after she received that flood of attack, she backed away for a moment, but then she wrote an article later. And she says, "Ever the peacemaker, I promised to keep quiet on the subject until I had properly researched it. Well, I've now done that, and if anything, my views have strengthened." To put put the argument at its most basic, a man can decide to be female, take hormones if required by whatever sporting organization is concerned, win everything in sight, and perhaps earn a small fortune, and then reverse his decision and go back to making babies if he so desires. It's insane and it's cheating. I'm happy to address a transgender woman in whatever form she prefers, but I would not be happy to compete against her. It would not be fair. She's pretty strong here. But again, this is a lesbian woman. And it was so fascinating to me to see this kind of conflict between groups of people that you would typically put in the same kind of category. And it's just interesting that there can be this kind of conflict. Another man named Andrew Sullivan expands on this kind of controversy. Andrew Sullivan is also a gay man, and although it's sort of interesting, he has more conservative positions in different ways. But he wrote an article on this very controversy, this kind of controversy. And here's what he says. If you abandon biology in the matter of sex and gender altogether, you may help trans people live fuller, less conflicted lives, but you also undermine the very meaning of homosexuality. If you follow the current ideology of gender as entirely fluid, you actually subvert and undermine core arguments in defense of gay rights. The core of the traditional gay claim is that there is indeed a very big difference between male and female, that the difference matters, and without it, homosexuality would make no sense at all. We just have to abandon the faddish notion that sex is socially constructed or entirely in the brain, that sex and gender are unconnected, that biology is irrelevant, and that there is something called an LGBTQ identity when, in fact, the acronym contains extreme internal tensions and even outright contradictions. Again, he's strong, and this strength comes from a homosexual man. And what he's describing is something, again, is something very interesting. In the last 60 years, of course, we have experienced a sexual revolution. And at different points in those 60 years, different groups have really asserted themselves and fought for certain rights, probably beginning with feminist ideology, and then homosexual ideology, and then most recently transgenderism. The interesting thing, though, is that when you look across that spectrum, some of those groups are very interested in seeing gender as defined as something very fluid, something very non-binary, maybe even discarding the idea of gender altogether, while others in those groups would say, no, we need a clear, distinct definition of gender. Okay, in feminist camps or homosexual, that would be the position. When you see that conflict, though, it tells me something. It tells me that gender and sexuality, they're not the core issues. Okay, there's something bigger. There's some umbrella issue that ties all that together. And that's the self. That's personal autonomy. Okay, the question there isn't just about gender, although, of course, we do need to understand gender, and we need to understand what design and intention is behind gender. But it seems like the question there is, who gets to decide? Who gets to decide? Is it something objective, something outside of myself, say biology or God? Or do I get to decide? Okay, do I have the authority to determine who I am and what's right about myself? That's the question. So obviously, we see these major social issues heavily influenced by our perspective on self. Let's go to abortion as well, as long as we're here. let me save that for just a minute. We'll talk about abortion, obviously a really controversial issue. Both of these issues, obviously they've been controversial for a long time, but have been more so in just recent years. And I'd say even last year, abortion has gotten, there's obviously a lot of passion there, but even more so than several years ago, I would say. And what I wanted to share is a quote from New York Senator and actually until recently presidential hopeful Kirsten Gillibrand. And she is, in this interview, she shares that she thinks it's wrong to appoint pro-life judges. Okay? So here's her quote. And she says, "I think there's some issues that have such moral clarity that we have as a society decided that the other side is not acceptable. Imagine saying that it's okay to appoint a judge who's racist or anti-Semitic or homophobic. Asking someone to appoint someone who takes away basic human rights of any group of people in America, I don't think those are political issues anymore." Now, for those of us that are pro-life, you know, that can make your blood boil. But let's think about where this comes from again. She is saying there is such moral clarity. We've arrived at that place where it is obviously, it's evident that it is immoral to appoint a pro-life judge. Where does that come from? Well, it comes from this belief, this existentialist belief. Remember, essence does not start at existence, it starts later. And essence is found as you are able to express yourself with freedom, and as you are able to live out your choices, and you discover meaning and good and truth as you look inside and express it. And so we must fight for those rights. It's so obvious, there's such a moral clarity that if anything inhibits that kind of expression, like say a pregnancy, then that is absolutely wrong. It's obvious we've gotten to that place. That's some of the thinking. Again, very, very influenced by the kinds of ideas that we've been talking about. Next, let's go to the self and attitudes towards the church or towards God, towards Christianity. Now, we could talk about a lot here. We could talk about consumeristic attitudes in the church. We could talk about an aversion to anything that's institutional, because institutional, organizational is not good, and individual rights are. And so there are certain attitudes that we all have towards the church or to God himself. And again, I could describe this in a lot of different ways, but here's how I want to do it. I wanted to describe popular Bible verses, okay, in our world, especially in our country. You know, we can gather data on what are the most popular Bible verses in our world. Obviously, through Bible apps or through different Bible search engines, they can collect data and they can tell you what verses are typically searched for or referenced. And they can do it, of course, by country, by region of the world. It's really interesting. The most popular Bible verse in Afghanistan and Israel is Zechariah 14:9. Anybody know Zechariah 14:9? I didn't. Couldn't tell you off the top of my head. But in Israel and Afghanistan, this is the most popular verse, according to the data that they've collected. And it's this: "And the Lord will be king over all the earth. On that day, the Lord will be one and his name one." In these regions of the world, Christians in Afghanistan, Christians in Israel, these are the biblical ideas, the truths that they're going to grab onto, that are going to be really important to them, which is pretty interesting. What about us in the United States? Well, here are the top four for us here. And these get mixed up each year, is from what I understand. And sometimes one of them takes the number one spot, sometimes a different one takes the number one spot. But these are generally the top four, and they're kind of neck and neck. Now, John 3:16, which, you know, obviously is a great, concise summary of the gospel. God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life. And so you see that at football games, you see that in a lot of different places, and that's really, really important verse for us to summarize the gospel. The next three are the interesting ones, though. There's Jeremiah 29:11. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you, not to harm you, plans to give you a hope and a future. And there's Philippians 4:13, I can do everything through Christ who strengthens me. And there's Romans 8:28, which talks about how God works all things together for the good of those who love him. Now, those are all really important truths. I love all those verses. Obviously, they're in the Bible. We cling to those. They bring important pieces to our faith. Sometimes they're taken out of context, each one of those, but nevertheless, they are important truth. But it's just interesting the kinds of truths that become primary in our thinking here in the West. And those truths are, God will plan to do something good for me, and God empowers me. That's what we love. That's what we love to read in the Bible. Again, I don't want to downplay those important truths. We do need to grab onto those. If those are some of your favorite verses, you don't need to discard them. But we just have to understand that our thinking is shaped. And even as we read the Bible, even as we approach church, as we approach God, it comes through a me-centric filter. That's just how we do things. So that I wanted again to just raise our awareness and help us think about how these philosophies influence us in so many different ways. That they are everywhere. When we recognize that, though, it might stir a couple things in us. One, I think we should recognize that because this is everywhere, it's absolutely everywhere, whether it's on our Kleenex packages or whether it's shaping how we think about major social issues, this is just the air that we breathe. But when we recognize that, we should also understand that, okay, if I am repeating these things or if I'm thinking in a certain way that aligns with some of these ideas that I've just shared, I am a product of my culture. Sometimes we think we're pretty free and independent thinkers, but we're not. And we've all been shaped. And we were born into this world that began to shape us in all kinds of different ways from 1,000 different angles. And so we have been shaped. And so we just need to understand that. But I think one important thing to understand also is how ideas in culture become popular. So often, I think there can be a wave of philosophy that sweeps over a culture, and it's just so compelling and so appealing that everybody jumps on board, and it happens so quickly. But we jump on that bandwagon before properly vetting it. You know, sometimes it just seems really appealing on the surface, and so we give our hearts there, but we don't do the work to really think about it, really to consider, is there a sturdy foundation underneath that? And we don't wait to see what kind of fruit it produces and if it's good or bad, and we just get on that bandwagon, and then we're all in before we even know it. But the Bible really warns us against that. Romans 12:2. Says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. So don't be conformed to the world. Don't just ride that wave thoughtlessly right away. I mean, there may be good in there, but there may not be. So don't just give in right away, but instead be transformed and renew your mind. We got to renew it. And then test, and we can test what the will of God is, and what's good and acceptable and perfect. Last week, I talked about Jean-Paul Sartre a little bit and how he was a pretty key figure in popularizing some of these ideas in the middle of the 20th century. And I also talked a little bit about his lifestyle and how he lived this sort of extravagant, although intriguing, lifestyle. And he became a little bit of a celebrity through that lifestyle, and that perhaps many of his ideas were accepted not on the basis of their merit, but just because this was so intriguing and attractive, and it seemed like he was breaking new ground, and it seemed like he had it figured out, and he was happy. Now, in reality, as I mentioned last week, found out later, even after his death, that it was anything but happy, and that there was a lot of mess in there. But you don't see that on the surface, and sometimes you just jump right in and ride that wave because it seems like, yeah, this is a compelling way to live, and you don't properly vet what's underneath there. So my intention here was first, through last week and the first part of this week, was to again make us aware, to help us understand that it is just everywhere and it shapes us profoundly. But then to begin to step back and ask some questions and say, how stable is this foundation? We've all just jumped in fully. We've plunged into this sea. But have we really asked the questions that we need to? And so I want to ask just a few questions, and I'm not going to elaborate on these a lot, and we will a little bit more next week. But I want to ask some questions to, again, help us vet and test some of these ideas. And what I'll do is I'll ask the question and share an observation or two from the world that might challenge the answer to this question, challenge the philosophy underneath it, and then share Bible also and see what the Bible has to say about some of these issues. So the first question: should we really trust our inner world as much as we are encouraged to? Well, the Bible says no. Actually, absolutely not. So Jeremiah 17:9, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it? This is the theme of the Bible, that we're pretty confused, that the heart is pulled in a lot of different directions, and it is deceitful. But I think we can understand this ourselves as well. You know, if I am really honest with myself, I probably have to acknowledge that I'm pretty confused down there. And one moment I feel drawn this way, and another moment I feel drawn this way, and it's really hard to sort things out down there. And we can probably all acknowledge, as we were growing up, we went through all kinds of different phases. And sometimes we were convinced that a certain way was the way to go, and then a year or two later, maybe we were going in the opposite direction. And I think, again, if we're honest, we just have to say that it's pretty confusing, it's pretty messy, it's just this tied-up knot down underneath the surface. And that the Bible is saying something that is true about ourselves here. We could ask the question, should the virtue of authenticity have as high of a position as we have given it? Well, I think authenticity is a great thing. I think the Bible does as well. The Bible encourages authenticity. We could go to James 5:16. It says, therefore, confess your sins to one another and pray for one another that you may be healed. Confess your sins. That's pretty authentic. The Bible encourages honesty. Most certainly, it encourages honesty, transparency, to be very, very open with who you are. So authenticity is a very good thing. The thing is, though, the Bible makes it clear that authenticity is a means to an end. It must be. I believe in our world, authenticity is an end in itself. That's the pinnacle virtue that we're shooting for. But in the Bible, it says, no, confess your sins, be authentic, so that you may be healed. And that's the purpose of authenticity. That's the purpose of honesty. I want to be very open with myself so that I can grow and even become something different than I am. That's the purpose of authenticity. Number three, should passion be the driving force that we have made it to be? Well, if you look at the Bible, the word passion is not used positively. I'll give you just one quick example. So flee youthful passions and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace along with those who call on the Lord from a pure heart. And many times in the Bible, passion is spoken of negatively. I think also, if you look around our world, maybe especially in the business world, you know, where we've been told to follow your passion in terms of work and vocation, I've noticed a handful of articles of people, whether Christian or non-Christian, questioning that encouragement to follow your passion. I'll give you a couple examples. Cal Newport from Georgetown University, an author of So Good They Can't Ignore You, Why Skills Trump Passion in the Search for Work You Love. He says, telling someone to follow their passion from an entrepreneur's point of view is disastrous. Passion is not something you follow. Passion is something that will follow you as you put in the hard work to become valuable to the world. Very similarly, Jeff Hayden from Inc. Magazine says, according to research, what is the strongest predictor of a person seeing her work as a calling? The number of years spent on the job. The more experience you have, the more likely you are to love your work. Why? The more experience you have, the better your skills and the greater your satisfaction in having those skills. The more experience you have, the more you can see how your work has benefited others. Where business success is concerned, passion is almost always the result of time and effort. It's not a prerequisite. It's very interesting that many of these people are making the case more for nurture than nature in that classic debate. Okay, that things like passion, they're not necessarily just inherent, is what these guys are arguing. That it's something that is developed, and that nurture and experience really comes into play there. And they're cautioning against giving too much credit to nature. You know, it is really interesting that I think our world gives a lot of credit to nature and speak, even though they reject God, speak almost as if there's design and intention in who we are, who we've been designed to be. Because we have to discover that, because there's something there, there's some kind of intention in how we are designed, and so we have to find it and pursue it. It's really pretty interesting. As Christians, we believe in both nature and nurture. There is design and there is intention in us, but there's also a lot that influences us and shapes our lives as we go along. And so we have to be careful about letting passion just be the compass. Number four, can a hyper-focus on self really lead to compassion and charitableness? Philippians 2 says, do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit. Pretty plainly, do nothing from selfish ambition. But in humility, count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. You know, when I ask that question, can a hyper-focus on self really lead to compassion and charitableness, I really struggle to see if it truly can. If I have been convinced and or encouraged from every direction all my life to think about myself first and foremost and to really try to exalt myself, can I really turn around and be genuinely compassionate, genuinely consider other people's interests? Can I really do that? I'm doubtful. You know, I think everybody wants to do that. I mean, they that's promoted, certainly. Benevolence is promoted. But I find it hard to believe that if I am just bombarded with so many messages that say, pursue self, pursue self, pursue self, I don't know if I can get there in any real way. And then finally, number five, has our pursuit of self-interest really led to the kind of happiness we hoped for? We've mentioned many times from this stage that something in our world has changed in recent decades. There is a dramatic increase in anxiety, in despair, these sorts of things, depression. And you just have to question things. Okay, does this hyper focus on self not only correspond to, but correlate with this kind of despair that is everywhere in our culture? Okay, has the self really delivered on its promises? And we can ask that in a personal way too. Okay, have I really pursued self? Have I bought into a lot of these messages, and has that been my central focus? But has it gotten me the kind of happiness and fulfillment that I hoped it would? I think often the answer is no, it hasn't. And we have been steeped in this for many decades now, and I'm not convinced it has brought us to a very good place. So we have to heed Colossians 2:8, just like we mentioned last week. See to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy and empty deceit, according to human tradition, according to the elemental spirits of the world, and not according to Christ. Okay, there is a lot of philosophy out there. Some of it can be good, some of it can be bad, but we've got to be careful, and we've got to see to it that no one takes us captive before we've really thought about it. We have to understand this well. Now, all of that said, there can be some questions that are asked that might come to mind right away. For example, okay, if you're railing on self-pursuit and pursuit of passion and things like this, well, are emotions to be ignored? Okay, if I'm feeling passionate about something, does that warrant any merit? Or is any kind of introspection to be avoided? Should I just not really dig in there and think about myself at all? Or three, should we eliminate desire from our lives? Again, I've tried to harp on this idea of following your passion and said it's got some holes in it. Does that mean that I shouldn't desire and go more the kind of the Buddhist route? Or fourth, is ambition wrong? Should I avoid any kind of self-betterment, those types of things? Well, I think the answer to all these questions is also no. How so? Well, you have to come back next week to find out, actually. Because that's where we're going, really. And what I wanted to do thus far is, again, make us very aware, show us that this kind of thinking is everywhere, and you and I are influenced in dramatic ways by these philosophies. And then I wanted to start to poke at that a little bit and start to vet what's underneath there and expose some pretty unstable foundation underneath these ideas. But now that we've kind of deconstructed a little bit, we got to reconstruct. We've got to understand, well, what is the self? How does God want us to think about this? What are his intentions for us? And of course, that's where we're going next week. Band, you can go ahead and come on back up here. We're going to sing one more song. But as they come up, let me give you just a little bit of a preview. So Mark 8:34 through 35 says this: Jesus, calling the crowd to him with his disciples, he said to them, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it." Jesus constantly talks about this exchange, and that we bring ourselves to him, and we lay it down, and we lay down ourselves, but there's something that there's some kind of trade made. Okay, it's like we lose our lives, we give up our lives just like he did, and then he grants us life. That's what we're going to get into next week.